getting you healthy, happy, and doing what you love. You're listening to Tonic Podcast, the podcast of Dr. Tanya Winchester. Dr. Tanya is a licensed naturopathic doctor, acupuncturist, body talk practitioner, and edutainer with a passion for helping reduce pain and suffering and bringing more love, joy, and health into your life and into the world. The natural medicines and therapies mentioned in this podcast are not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for seeking medical attention. For more information about Dr. Tanya Winchester, visit Dr. Tanya, T-O-N-I-A, Winchester.com. This is Farah, and I'm delighted to be here with Dr. Tanya Winchester. And today's subject for the podcast is mental health in celebration of Psychology Awareness Month. And our specific topic in relation to mental health is depression and anxiety.
Absolutely. Yep, I'm really happy to be talking about this today. Such an important one.
So tell us, how does naturopathic medicine understand depression and anxiety? What exactly is it?
Well, both are biochemical changes that go on in the body. Depression, of course, is related to a lowered mood state relating to certain different neurotransmitters. So these are the chemicals in the brain that tell different nerves to respond to things in different ways. And anxiety is when our stress level is sort of heightened more regularly than it should be or would be physiologically normal.
And so the brain is, brain health is a really important aspect of depression, and stress levels are a big aspect of anxiety.
Yes, and absolutely. And to answer your first question, which I didn't really fully finish answering, naturopathic medicine is always looking at the bigger, broader picture of these things. So we're not just looking at the isolated symptom or disease state. We're fitting that into how the body as a whole is responding to its environment. And that's very unique. So every single person is going to have a different set of factors that are acting as root causes. And every single person is going to be in a different environment, which will sort of be triggering those causes. So we're always looking at things very holistically and very individually and trying to get to the root cause of why those symptoms are there in the first place.
So you've probably seen a lot of patients, and without having to talk about specific people, what do you notice are some of the root causes of mental illness?
Yes, and I would say there are lots, and generally they're all the same for the same, or for different disease states, they're all generally can be fitting into a few different categories. But food is a really good place to start. And there is a lot of data now that shows us that the body will have a biochemical response to certain foods, which can trigger inflammation in the system, which can actually change our neurological health. So looking at finding reactive or inflammatory foods becomes really important. Another player is looking at vitamin deficiencies and or mineral deficiencies, basically nutrient deficiencies. And so this could be a B12 issue, it could be a B6 issue, maybe it's an essential fatty acid issue where the body's just not getting access to that nutrient. And that could be related to two things. Either they're not exposed to that nutrient in their diet, or the gut's not functioning well and it's not absorbing those nutrients. So we can also look at the foods that we take in that are covered in toxins. So these are actually going to slow down how the cells create energy in our body. And when we can't create the right amount of energy in our body, we go into a more depressed or anxious state.
So it sounds like there's a lot of possibility for food, diet, and gut to be a big part of mental health.
Yes, the gut has to be considered. It's very interesting. It's actually often called the second brain. And the digestive system is rich in nerve cells. So there's actually more nerves in your digestive system than there are in the spinal cord. And more serotonin. So serotonin is one of those feel-good neurotransmitters that I was mentioning earlier. Serotonin production is the highest in the digestive system, and also there's the highest amount of receptors for serotonin, the actual molecule in the gut. So this isn't just an isolated above the neck problem. This is absolutely a whole body issue.
And serotonin is defined as one of those happy hormones or happy
chemicals. It's one of our feel-good molecules. That's right.
Wow, how interesting that so much is connected to food, the gut, diet.
Yes, that's one huge area that we can explore with naturopathic medicine when it comes to those two disease states. And another one would be stress. So the body, you know, if we look at nature, I always like to use nature as my greatest teacher. So if we look at nature, when an animal is stressed, it will typically do one of four things, and that's fight or flight. So it'll, you know, be aggressive in the situation and try to fight and protect itself, or it will run away. That's the flight. Or in some cases, faint or freeze. And we can kind of see those two or those four ways that animals would respond to stress in two categories. And one is sort of more revved up, that's the fight or flight, and then another is more revved down, and that would be the faint or freeze. And so we could kind of akin those to the anxiety and depression respectively.
Mm-hmm. So it could be the case that chronic exposure to stress and the stress response could lead to mental illness.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's changes biochemically that happen that would impede that serotonin production, for example, or change how different neurotransmitters are produced in the brain. So there's lots of data also that shows, you know, exposure to high levels of stress hormones deplete certain neurotransmitters in the brain, including acetylcholine and dopamine, all of these things.
So when advising patients who you understand that stress is a factor in their illness and can contribute to their well-being, how do you address it? Because stress can come from relationships, from work, from just how we perceive a situation.
Absolutely. And so one of the things that I think is really important to remember is that anything that the body doesn't like is stressful. So stress could also be a food in this instance. Now, I think the first step is to really highlight where the stressors are coming from. And that's something that we do in our first meeting together, is we go through several different categories and we get quite deeply into the factors that are stressing them out. So what's stressing you out? And they'll say work. And so, well, that's not enough for me. What aspect of work is stressful? Is it, you know, are there deadlines that are hard to meet? Is there bullying going on in the workplace? Are you not making enough money? Like, we'll actually find as clearly as possible the actual stress itself. So first step is shining a light on it. And then, you know, sometimes it's impossible to change those things, but I really think that there's always a way of rearranging our lives so that we're not in those situations anymore. We just have to sometimes be courageous and creative. And I think the other step is, we'll actually, we're planning to talk a little bit on this, about this on the next podcast, but there is a space between stress and your response where we can intervene and change your perception of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. So just identifying the root cause can be enough to help people devise strategies to figure out how to eliminate or manage that stress.
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's come back to the food thing, because it's such a big part of it. You know, we rely on certain foods, and suppose it becomes clear that we're ingesting certain foods that aren't helpful to our health, but those foods are not something that we're willing to give up yet.
Right, right. I heard this interesting way of thinking about this the other day, which I'm really excited to share here. So I often will have that where patients are resistant to making changes that I know from my own experience would benefit them.
For example, what kind of changes?
Well, dairy and wheat are really two common ones that we can think of. Sugar I would put up there in the top three to consider. And certainly with the first two I mentioned, the dairy and the wheat, there's proteins within those foods that actually have been found bound to different neurotransmitter receptors in the brain. So they're stimulating pathways, triggering things that are out of balance. Also, our opioid pathways, so the receptors in the brain that respond to morphine and heroin, codeine, all those drugs, these foods will actually trigger those same pathways. So, A, that also leads into sort of a discussion about those foods being potentially addictive, but I'm going to leave that for now. So when there is resistance in patient's compliance, I certainly have a lot of compassion for that resistance, because behaviors are hard to change, right? Habits are hard to change. They're very ingrained, and also in our society kind of connect us to people that we love in certain ways. So this is the phrase that I heard the other day. We can't find motivation first. We actually just have to commit as an experiment, kind of blindly, because we don't know how they're going to respond to the intervention of maybe removing those foods, but commitment comes first. So maybe we decide, let's just try 30 days avoiding these foods, and most likely people will start to feel better fairly quickly. Often within, I'd say, 5 days to 2 weeks, people are starting to notice changes, and that's when the motivation starts to come. When people start to feel better is when they're committed to continue going. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was a really interesting way of kind of interjecting that motivation commitment cycle. We start actually with the commitment. Mm-hmm. Just try it. Mm-hmm. Be 100% good with it for a certain period of time, and then the motivation comes.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes people might not know how bad they're feeling until they start feeling better.
Yes, and that's a really great thing you brought up. We are very good at processing information as humans. We have so much coming at us all the time, and most of it we're not consciously aware of, including how foods are making us feel. So certain foods, when we eat them and our body doesn't like them, they can take up to 3 to 5 days to express itself as a symptom. So it can be hard to look at a diet diary and pin down what the trigger was. Was it the tomato? Was it the cheese? Was it the, you know, shrimp cocktail I ate 5 days ago at the party? We don't know. I mean, certainly there's ways of finding this stuff out, but just looking at a diet diary makes it really hard. So
what kind of diagnostic tools then would you use to kind of pinpoint what foods may that the body may be responding negatively to?
There's different options. There's certainly some blood tests that are possible. Every test comes with pros and cons. I often like to embark on a period of elimination and reintroduction, then we get a fairly clear sense of what foods are triggering what symptom. Mm-hmm.
So elimination, so that, and then reintroduction, and elimination, yeah. In terms of the period of elimination?
That depends. It could be anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks would be a starting spot. Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed in your practice that there are certain times of the year or certain cycles to depression and anxiety?
Yes. I mean, certainly we'll see more depressive tendencies in the winter when people don't have access to as much light, and that's a, you know, a vitamin D deficiency issue. There's certainly ways that we can support that through supplementation. Also, you've probably heard of those, you know, light boxes. There's even a company that makes a visor that you can wear in the morning to get access to that full spectrum light to start to improve those vitamin D levels. And in terms of anxiety, that's not something I see seasonally. I would say that is something that is fairly year-round, although there are, going back to school is a time that I see sort of heightened stress. Christmas time I would put in that category as well. And I would just say those are more, circumstantial and situational as opposed to something in the environment.
Mm-hmm. What about personalities? Are there certain personalities that are more prone to mental illness?
I'm not sure I would want to say yes to that. I think anyone could be susceptible to anything, depending again on what their biochemistry is doing, what their environment is providing them, how they're reacting to that environment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked a lot about food, and is there anything else about the gut health and the connection to the brain that would be helpful in terms of understanding mental health and that connection between the brain in our head and the brain in our...
Yes, that second brain. Gut. The one thing we haven't talked yet about is the microbiome. So these are all the organisms that hang out in our body. You know, our body cells are 30 trillion in number, and we have triple the number of bacteria in our body. And some people will say that there's 3 to 5 pounds of bugs in our system, primarily in the gut, but really at any mucous membrane and also in our skin. The microbiome, when it's in a healthy, balanced state, will help us do important things like break down food, digest our food for us, produce certain vitamins, including some of those B vitamins I mentioned that are important for some of those neurotransmitters, and also improve the immune system. And again, coming back to this idea of inflammation, if the immune system's out of balance and the system is inflamed, then that's going to affect our neurological health. And so we can actually alter the bugs in the gut and change how the biochemistry in the brain is.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to hear you talk about inflammation, because generally I think inflammation has conventionally been understood in terms of muscular perspective. But here you're talking about it in terms of body tissue, organs, and brain.
Yeah, inflammation is inflammation. It shuts down our normal cellular processes. We're not able to access the energy production like I mentioned earlier. It can affect any system. And certainly there's a molecule called histamine, which you've probably all heard of. Histamine, there's several different types of histamine receptors in the body, and there's good evidence that shows that histamine is actually connected into some of these more neurological or mentally brain-based illnesses.
So if someone is having allergic responses, it could be indicative, or it could have an impact on the brain.
Yeah, and going back to, if we're eating a food that's not good for us biochemically, that will trigger a histamine release. It not necessarily is about the pollens and stuff in the environment. It could certainly be something we're consuming internally.
Mm-hmm. So coming back to where we started, which was depression and anxiety, you know, as a naturopathic doctor, what are some preventative measures that people can take that are simple and easy in mental wellness?
Yeah, and I'll talk about two main ones, and these are going to apply to both of those. And so one is some sort of quiet or meditative practice, whether that's just deep breathing or visualization, whether that is a yin yoga practice, for example, or even a more flow-based yoga practice. And then that would segue me into the second, which is getting regular exercise. So these two things are sort of our stress fighters. And if we go back to the idea of what happens in nature, and the example of that fight or flight, say there's a lion chasing a gazelle, both of those animals are going to be in fight or flight mode. Their stress response is revved up during that chase. And so let's say the gazelle survives this particular chase. Both animals have survived. What their nervous system is doing now is saying, okay, we've survived. We can go back into rest, digest, and heal mode, and we don't have to stay in fight or flight mode. So in our human world, we often just sit in fight or flight. We're at work, we're at our desk. We don't get to sort of physically shake off that experience. So I do actually advocate regular exercise for sure, but even introducing sprinting into your day. So this could mean a minute of intense something. So maybe some jumping jacks or burpees or squats or running in place or taking a flight of stairs up and down. And no more than about 60 seconds. And it's enough to tell your nervous system that you have survived the threat, which is probably not life-threatening in most cases. And you can unwind and unpack and go back into rest or digest mode.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest breathing or some kind of quiet, you know, introspective practice, and then these short bursts of activity to help both of those conditions.
It's very interesting. I once saw a YouTube video of a old master who was more than 100 years old, and they asked him, what's the secret to longevity? And he said, stillness and movement.
Yeah, nice. That's beautiful. Yes.
So what a great place to end. Simple things that people can do to cultivate mental wellness. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Tonic Podcast, the podcast of Dr. Tanya Winchester. getting you healthy, happy, and doing what you love. The natural medicines and therapies mentioned in this podcast are not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for seeking medical attention. For any health concern, it's always best to make an appointment to see a licensed medical practitioner. For more articles and blog posts, visit Dr. Tanya, T-O-N-I-A, Winchester.com, or visit us in beautiful Nanaimo, BC at Tonic Naturopathic Clinic. Have a delightful day.